Well, Wayne, welcome back to Radio Times. One of the memories of my childhood is practicing the piano and watching the egg timer slowly ticking down second by second. It was agonizing and endless, and I hated it. Our guest, Thomas Sterner, played guitar and piano when he was young and didn't enjoy practicing either. That changed when he got older and began to think differently about what it means to practice something. It's what he writes about in his book called The Practicing Mind, Developing Focus and Discipline in Your Life. Sterner was the chief concert piano technician for the Grand in Wilmington, Delaware. He's also an accomplished musician, private pilot, avid golfer, among other activities. And he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. I'm thrilled to be here.
So did you watch that egg timer too when you were little?
Actually, I did, and I didn't do very well at it. When I was young, I started a lot of programs, you know, not just the guitar, but the piano later. The piano didn't come along until I was about 9 years old. We didn't have a piano.
Right.
And I was very aware that I followed a pattern of behavior. I would get excited about starting out on the instrument, and then very shortly into it, maybe a month or so, I was a terrible student. I didn't like practicing, and I came up with every excuse I could not to do it. Sometime, probably in my mid-20s, I would class myself as very undisciplined.
Right. And was that true in other parts of your life?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In everything, whether I wanted to exercise, any type of an activity or skill that I wanted to develop, I always started off with really high hopes and a lot of energy, and then that initial enthusiasm would drop off, and then I would start making excuses to get out of it.
And was it a matter of losing interest, or you just didn't like practicing, the kind of monotony, the repetitiveness of practicing?
I think that had a lot to do with it. I don't know if I had quantified it at that age. You know, I really was trying to figure that out. I think what saved me was that I was aware that I followed that pattern over and over again, and it disappointed me in myself, and I felt that I didn't have any self-power. I thought, if I can't pick an activity and see it through, then I really am not in control of what I accomplish and being able to get to where I wanted to get. When I was about 25, pretty much everybody referred to me as a highly disciplined person.
Oh, interesting.
I started to look back on my life and say, well, I was here, now I'm here, how did I get to there? And I started reviewing all that, and that's really where the book started to come from.
Indeed, and it was an interesting introduction to golf, a very difficult sport, obviously. I mean, I've tried hitting that golf ball. It's really a hard thing to do. But it seemed like your experience with golf opened up some ideas for you.
I think that my experience with golf showed me a way to understand what I had learned. When I got into college, I began studying Eastern thought. Somebody had given me a book on religions of the world, and I became fascinated by that. I was raised in the traditional Judeo-Christian religion in this country. And when I began to read that, I was fascinated by Zen mind, Buddhism, all of that sort of thing. And then when I got into golf, I immediately was attracted to the performance psychologies that were being developed. And so I really immersed myself in that. And what fascinated me was they were really just two sides of the same coin. What we were doing empirically was proving out what had been said thousands of years ago. And I started to see that with myself in my golf swing. I was became very immersed in just the process of practicing the swing and unattached to the result of what was going to happen.
That sounds very Zen.
It was very Zen. And what we're learning in our sports psychologies, which is now migrating into the business world and all, is that people are much more effective when they stay in the present moment, when they're not thinking about a lot of things. Multitasking, I would say, is on its way out. Actually, what we call multitasking doesn't really exist. They call it switch tasking. And what they realize is that when you're doing something and somebody pokes their head in the door and says, hey, you want to go to lunch at the deli today, and you stop and you look at them and you respond and then you go back to whatever your report you're working on or whatever, that your brain has to screech to a stop.
I know that feeling.
And then start back up again. And this goes on thousands of times during your day, and it takes a lot of energy.
Well, as you said, learning golf, you wanted to focus on that process. So are you a pretty good golfer? I mean, because oftentimes – I'm a tennis player. Oftentimes the goal is, you know, to win that point or to win that game or to win that set. That the goal is to beat your opponent.
Yes, I actually did become a pretty good golfer. I was a single-digit handicap in a fairly short period of time, and I was told – which, again, was more of a confirmation to me that I was onto something by – all of the PGA pros that I worked with, that they were kind of dumbfounded at how I had gotten to where I was in a short period of time, mostly being self-taught. And I used to just always say, well, I practice a lot. Right. But I wasn't just practicing, repeating things. I was repeating with an intention, and I was focused on what I was doing, and also I was focusing on doing it right.
Well, and what I got from reading your book is this, the importance of being self-aware. I mean, as you say, everything we do is a result of some degree of practice or perhaps lack of practice. But knowing yourself and knowing, I think, your effect on the world, knowing what it is you are doing or not doing, that seems to open up all sorts of interesting doors.
I think one of the problems is that we don't understand ourselves very well. Many times we view the experience when we start out on a challenge, we view what we interpret as difficulty and that feeling and the emotions that go with it as our enemy. But in reality, we crave difficult activities. If you look at video games, you know, I've taught junior golf clinics, and I've asked the kids, you know, what do you do with a video game after you master it? And they all yell, you throw it away. And I said, that's right. So why is that? I said, because you enjoy the fact that you can't do it, but eventually you can. And the advantage that they have is that they don't really have a goal in the sense that I'm going to master this game and then I'm going to be done. They think, well, I'll master this skill and then I get rid of it and get another one to master. So they're very involved in the enjoyment of mastering the skill. We don't take that into everything else in our life.
But I think the challenge is making practice interesting. And I mean, there is repetition in practice. I mean, part of how you get better at something is you do it over and over again. How do you make it interesting each time?
Well, I think that feeling of this is not interesting,
right.
Because I always kind of look at the opposite.
And I know that feeling as well, yes.
I've tried to look at that in myself when I take an activity and say, why do I consider this fun and this activity not fun? And I'm talking about, you can take something like studying for a test and reading a novel. The mechanics are basically the same, but we define one as fun and one is not fun. So I really kind of tried to understand that in myself, and I realized that I was making judgments, and then I was interpreting those judgments, and then immediately what I was doing over here was fun and what I was doing over here wasn't fun, even though they were very similar in terms of the mechanics of the nature. And I also think that we misuse the goal. We set a goal, which is to play piano or something, and then we immediately – well, maybe a better example is losing weight. Let's say we're going to lose 30 pounds. Then we immediately become attached to the 30 pounds. So now what we've done is we've put ourselves in a position where everything that happens between now and that 30 pounds is drudgery. We look at that journey as being drudgery instead of focusing on the enjoyment of bringing ourselves back to the diet on a, you know, first for breakfast and then for lunch. And so I think that has a lot to do with it, is how we approach practice, because that sets up what our perspective of our experience is going to be.
But it seems to me it also helps to be passionate about the thing that you are practicing. I mean, I was not a good piano player. There was no future for me whatsoever. And I think that colored my experiences as a kid. I don't think I'm alone in that. But you can see people that are just so passionate about something, so willing to invest emotional energy, time and energy into this thing that they're pursuing.
Absolutely. I think that one of the things that we learn from the arts is that practice is akin to breathing. You know, it's really like breath is to life, practicing is to art. I mean, it's just part of being involved in whatever art form it is, whether that's dance or music. And so I think that people – I heard an interview with Wynton Marsalis one time, and somebody said, how do you get so good at what you're doing? And he said, you have to enjoy the solitude of creating a relationship with your instrument. Mm. And see, that's a perspective that somebody like him has. So when he sits down with his instrument, he's not looking at it, oh, geez, I got 2 hours of these scales to do. He's looking at it as he's building a relationship with the instrument. So it's these subtle perspective changes really have an effect on our experience.
You describe, you were for a while a professional piano tuner, but you describe what it is to tune a piano, knowing that a professional is going to sit down and play it, and very painstaking. I mean, it seems to me there are a lot of skills you have to have, and you have to be pretty exacting, and that could drive you crazy, right?
It is. It's an extremely monotonous job, and you're not only tuning one piano, but many times you're tuning a bunch all day long, and then there's driving, and there's also pressure that goes with it. You know, there more than one time I was working with a world-class soloist, and the people were standing out on Market Street waiting for he and I to figure out what was going on with the piano before they let them in. So it can be stressful at times. But
it seems like you were able to at least learn to take your mind somewhere. You could do this.
I made a decision.
Take your mind somewhere else.
Yes, I made the decision that I had, if I focused on the fact that I had, you know, when you tune a piano, there's 235 strings, and you're going to have to tune each one of them at least once. And when you finish that one, you're going to go to the next one. So, you know, you really have to develop a mindset of there has to be some enjoyment in just doing what I'm doing right now.
Yeah.
And when you begin to experience that, then it inspires you to want more of it and to work more along those lines.
So what was your mindset? You had to do this thing, but what, where were you?
Well, one of the things that I learned was that there's a story in the book about slowing down. And I had a job where I was overbooked for the day and I had too much to do. And so what I did was I made this decision because I was stressed out. This was just on the tail of many, many days of this. I was working almost 80 hours a week, 7 days a week. And I made a decision that what I was going to do was be very deliberate and slow. So this is how I started this process. And the reason was because I was exhausted. And I thought, I need a break. I'm not going to get a break, a physical break, meaning I'm going to go sit in a restaurant for an hour. So I need the break to happen while I'm doing this work. Instead of my body feeling tense and anxious and trying to work very quickly, I decided I was going to work very deliberately and very slow. So I left every clock in everything that had any kind of time on it, I left in the car, and as I walked to the theater or to the hall, I walked very deliberately, you know, watching my steps and brought my mind into that. And then I did the whole tuning process that way. I took one tool at a time out of the toolbox instead of grabbing handfuls of tools and throwing them in the piano. And what I found was that initially my mind was reeling. I mean, it was just screaming at me, you know, what the heck are you doing here? You are really creating an issue for the rest of the day. But I kept shutting that off and just said, well, I'm worth this time here. And what I found was that all the stress just dropped away because I wasn't thinking about anything other than what I was doing, because it took all of my mental effort to work slowly. You know, it's very difficult to do something slow because we're ramped up in everything that we do. So when you tell yourself, I'm going to do something slow, it's almost like you're learning it for the first time. And as I got through the cut to the chase, when I got through the tuning, and got back to the car, I'd actually picked up a half an hour. And I thought, this just cannot be. Well, actually, what I learned from that was that I have a tremendous amount of wasted energy when I'm working quickly. I'm just not aware of it because it feels like I'm going fast, but in reality, I'm not.
And the other things you talk about, we're up on a break here, simplify, which is simplifying a project, small, being aware of your goal, and also short.
Right.
Just to add to the S's. And we are talking with Thomas Sterner today on Radio Times about practice. And he's written a book called The Practicing Mind, Developing Focus and Discipline in Your Life. We'd love to hear from you. I shared my struggles with practice, and we'd love to hear from you as well. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Glenn Mead, an independent investment and wealth management firm for families, family offices, and endowments and foundations seeking thoughtful advice generation after generation. Details are available from Chip Wilson at 215-419-6100.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Tchaikovsky poured his soul into each of his symphonies, symphonies that would express his inner anguish and romantic passions. The Philadelphia Orchestra, under Jaap van Zweden, performs Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony. For your tickets, 215-893-1999 or at philorg.org. This Friday and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, Tchaikovsky's Fourth with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
WHYY-FM. You listen, you enjoy, and you know you're going to make a donation. So why not just do it now? And if you do, you can enjoy YStream, our regular WHYY-FM programming delivered online without membership breaks. Sign up for YStream by April 22nd. For more information and to make your donation now, visit whyy.org/YStream.
Programming is supported by 21st Century Cyber Charter School, providing public online education for grades 6 through 12. utilizing the latest information and communication technology. More information at 21stcenturycyber.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Thomas Sterner about practicing. He's got a book called The Practicing Mind, and we've got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You actually referenced children, and I'm glad you did, because I think, I mean, children are practicing all the time. They wouldn't call it that because right. They're playing.
That's right.
But they're learning things. They're learning to master things. You can see it with little babies. You can see it with toddlers. You know, you can see it through their development.
And that goes back to what we said earlier, which is it's a perspective. You know, they don't look at it. They're not attached to this result that they have to get to. They're just completely immersed in what they're trying mm-hmm. to learn. And that's a, you know, in Zen mind, they call that beginner's mind. When we're trying to learn something for the first time, it's ironic. You know, we're very focused on it, and our mind is still, and it doesn't have room for anything other than learning what it is. You know, driving a car is a perfect example.
Exactly.
But then as you become more and more proficient at the skill, then it becomes more and more automatic, and then the mind begins to walk around, and you start to have all these distractions. And in some things, that can be a problem. Golf is a very good example of that, because what they do is the reason that golf is so different than other sports is because it's not a reactionary sport where, like, say, tennis, the ball's hit at you, baseball, it's pitched to you, and your brain has to react, has to calculate and react very quickly. In golf, the ball sits there and waits for you to hit it. After you hit it, you have a long walk to the ball, and your brain has all this time to say, that was a lousy shot, right. And, you know, what are we going to do about this? And you got yourself into trouble, and that's going to affect your score. And all this judgment and that goes on behind that. So that's one of the reasons why golf has become such a proving ground for all of these psychologies, because there's a lot of money at stake. Guys end up losing their tour card, and they can't pay their mortgage. So we've really made a lot of room for that. But in that area there, what we've learned is that the perspective thing that you're talking about in the practicing mm-hmm. is not what it is in most of our lives in other areas, and that's why kids have that advantage.
Well, I'm thinking, as you were describing, the thoughts you can have as you're walking from one tee to the other, and I think we all have those tapes running in our heads, whether they're telling us that we're not good enough, or, I mean, those tapes can say many things, but it can get in the way, especially if you're working on something, it can get in the way of actually getting it done or feeling good about it.
Absolutely. You know, if you look at all the professionals in high-stress jobs, pilots, EMTs, they have procedures that they practice over and over again. Look at Sully landing on the Hudson. You know, the reason for those procedures is to stop that dialogue in a situation where your emotions start to take over. So you're right. If you look at people in athletes that are, quote, in the zone,
yes,
very still minds, eyes are very still. If you look at someone who's hyper and anxious, their eyes are darting all over the place. Their speech is very quick. So these are just outward signs that we are able to visually see that confirm this is how we are when we're focusing very well and our minds are still and we're feeling a lot more inner peace. This is how we are when we're very agitated. So how do we get to here is what we're looking for. And a lot of those things are being proven out. And I think that one of the big points is awareness of your thoughts.
Yeah, yeah. But we live in such a results-oriented society and probably world, and goal-oriented, goal-directed.
Well, that's true, and there's nothing wrong with that, except that it becomes a problem when we become attached to the goal. Because when we become attached to the goal, then we have this sense. I think most of us walk around with a sense of being incomplete, and whenever we pick this goal, we always have this feeling, and this is brought to us by media and marketing and everything, that when we get to this goal, this point, this stagnant point here, all of a sudden everything is going to feel good. We're going to feel good inside. We're going to feel happy. Even though we've proven to ourselves over and over again that that's not the truth. I mean, when you're young, it's your first car, it's your new cell phone or whatever, and you get all that stuff, and it's a bigger house, and you don't feel any different. You just move on to the next goal. So I think that these are the types of things that we need to look at and say, this paradigm is not working, and we need a different model.
And that's Thomas Sterner, our guest today in Radio Times. He was chief concert piano technician for the Grand in Wilmington, for Wilmington, Delaware, I should say, for a number of years. He is an accomplished musician, a private pilot, an avid golfer. He also does archery, and he joins us today in Radio Times to talk about practicing. And he's got a book called The Practicing Mind, Developing Focus and Discipline in Your Life. We have just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get some callers in. We have Michael, who called us up from Mount Airy. And Michael, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello, morning. Thank you very much for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
It's all about passion for me. I mean, I started playing golf when I was 9, and I still play golf today, but I'm not very good. I, you know, only play a few times a year, but I picked up photography when I was 10. And I never lost the passion for photography, and now I've been a professional photographer for 10 years.
Wow.
The passion is what does it. I mean, without the passion, I don't think you can have that stick-to-itiveness, which leads me to the last time I called, which was procrastination, but we won't go into that conversation.
That's funny, Michael.
But basically what happens is it does kind of feed back to that, is I procrastinate everything else mm-hmm. because I don't have the passion. But when it comes to the photography, I want to live with a camera in front of my face. I constantly want to push my abilities. I constantly want to get better at lighting. I want to get better at composing a shot. I want to get better at capturing the emotions of my subject, or, you know, the shadows of a structure or whatever. And, you know, it's all about that passion. And I think the passion is what drives it, even when I was a kid. I mean, my father was one who took me out on the golf course. But I didn't have the passion that he had. I didn't get bit by the bug. But the photography, I still have that passion today, and it's 40 years later. Well, I've been a professional for 10 years.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And, Michael, I remember your call to our procrastination show. Let me give Thomas Sterner a chance to weigh in. Go ahead.
Well, I think the passion definitely makes the sticking to it easier. You know, it's always, if you want to do something and you feel passionate about it, it really doesn't take a whole lot of discipline to do that. I think what... and he's absolutely right. I think that what we're trying to accomplish is there are things in life that we have to do that we don't particularly have passion for, and sometimes they're just have-tos. And when we need to be participating in that type of an event or a skill development, we don't want our mind to be such a terrible place mm-hmm. to live in all day. You know, we really want to try to get ourselves to where we can enjoy the development of the skill. See, and in some ways, it might not be as intense as the passion that that he feels when he plays or when he takes pictures, but at the same time, it won't be drudgery.
Well, and you're talking about a kind of a calmness, I guess, in where you don't get ahead of yourself, right?
Absolutely.
You try to stay in that moment of experience.
Yes, you know, and I'll give you an analogy a story. One time when I was at the Grand, we had an international pianist that came in, and it was just him and the piano. And I won't give his name, but at that time in his career, I was told that he had an alcohol problem, so he was prone to very high mood swings. And the way that they worked the piano in the theater in those days was it was held underneath of the stage, which a lot of concrete block and concrete floors. And then they would bring it up on the stage a day before the performance. Well, there was a big humidity difference in those two things. And the way that the scheduling was set up was I was supposed to come in at 1 o'clock, tune the piano, prep it, and he was supposed to come in at 5, play it for an hour, and then I would meet him at 6.
Right.
Well, he came into town the night before and got bored the next day and showed up at 12. And the piano had been pulled out the day before and gone through all these humidity changes. It's like it was waking up from hibernation, and it was just cacophonious. So the poor stagehand gets hit in the face with all these derogatory comments about the piano, and this artist is very upset about this instrument. So the stagehand calls me and says, you know, can you come in early? And I did, but I knew as soon as I got in the car to go in there, my mind started the thought process. You know, I got problems. This guy's not going to like me. What if he does this? What if he does that? And I immediately stopped that because I was aware that I was having these thoughts that were not going to prove productive. And I set up in my mind, I said, I need a procedure here. So I put out a procedure in my mind. I'm going to say this if he does that. I'm going to do this if he does that. And that way, you know, I had asked myself, if I could act any way I wanted to in this situation, what would it be? Because I had the opportunity to do that beforehand. So when I got into the theater and sat down behind the piano, it was awful. And sure enough, you know, here he comes, and he's got fire coming out of his eyes. And I'm expecting any minute he's going to put his thumb and index finger up, and I'm going to start choking. You know, I mean, he's like he was really
enraged.
He was enraged. And I stood up, and I introduced myself, and I apologized that someone of his accomplishments had to sit at the piano in the state it was in. I said, it's unforgivable. I said, it's really a miscommunication. And I told him also that I was very sympathetic to his position, because if he unlike the other instrumentalists in the orchestra, the piano doesn't or the pianist doesn't bring his own instrument. Everybody else pretty much brings their own instrument, so they know what they have. These people are the victim of the quality of the piano, the quality of the technician, the condition of the piano, the budget of the hall, all sorts of stuff. And it doesn't matter how much they practice, they're stuck with what they have when they get there. And the audience is really, they have no idea that.
Sure.
And this guy's sitting at this piano by himself.
Sure.
You know. And I explained this to him, and I could see his eyes softening and his body language softening. And he interrupted me and said, I'm sorry, what was your name? And I said, it was Tom. And he said, well, Tom, he said, I'm very confident that you can make this piano what I need it to be for tonight. And he said, so I'm going down to my dressing room, and then you know, you let me know when you're done. And I went down afterwards, and I said, why don't you come up and play? And he said, it's not necessary. He said, it's very clear to me that you understand where I'm coming from and where I what I have to deal with. So if you look at that, there's an example of being ahead of your thoughts, being separate from your thoughts, and realizing that this is not going to serve me. Everybody won. You know, I didn't get my blood pressure up. He didn't. The audience got a better performance. The theater worked. Everybody won in that situation. But it's a very subtle shift.
Well, but what you – I mean, it sounds like what you did, among many things, was to acknowledge the situation, and you had some sympathy for the position that he was in without being defensive.
Absolutely. And I might add that – being able to do that takes practice.
Right.
And if you get attached to this feeling of, when I can do that well, then I'm going to be happy, you're right back to where we're talking.
Let me get, looks like Jessica from Burlington Township to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Jessica, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I had a comment and then I guess a question for your guest. I noticed that Tom, you're talking a lot about Zen Buddhism, about beginner's mind, and referencing sports psychology. And one word I haven't heard you use is mindfulness. And I was curious as to, in your research for this book, if you've come across that. I had the opportunity as an MSW clinical student to work with dialectical behavior therapy. It's a cognitive behavior therapy that uses mindfulness and one mindfulness, and just that focus you're talking about, doing one thing at a time and not being anywhere but the present. I know Penn has, University of Pennsylvania has a stress management program for mindfulness. So I'm kind of wondering how that, if that informed any of your research.
It's a good question, Jesse. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, absolutely it did. Mindfulness is very much a part of Zen, but it's also in the performance psychologies today. The number one golfer in the world, Luke Donald, at the time last year was asked, if he won this one tournament, he was going to be number one in the world, and they asked him what he thought about that. And he said, well, I would not be very mindful if I was focusing on the result of winning the tournament. He said, if I'm mindful and in the present moment, he said, that's what got me here. Huh. And he said, one stroke at a time, one shot at a time, one decision at a time. So you're absolutely right. And also I've had a number of clinical psychologists come up to me and tell me that this is, I think in psychology, they talk about mindfulness therapy is what they call it. And they've said that the book was actually an excellent research for that. But I didn't mean it to be. You know, I mean, I was just writing it from where I came from.
From your own experience. But, you know, from my own experience, it can be hard to stay in that moment.
It can be, because everything we are taught is to not be in the moment. And we have so much to do in a day that what I think happens is, when we're working on one thing, we're aware peripherally that we have all these other things that have to be accomplished. So our mind goes out in search mode, and it's trying to solve all these problems all around us, the one that's on Tuesday, the one that's on Wednesday. It's upset about what I said 2 days ago, and it's everywhere but where we are, and we're not even aware of that.
Let me get Jessica, thanks for calling into Radio Times. We have Greg from South Jersey, and Greg, go ahead. You're on the air. That would be number five, Greg from South Jersey. No. Okay, we'll get back to our callers in just a moment at 1-888-477-9499. Now, you're a pilot, and I there's a lot of responsibility that goes into flying a plane, and you describe, having an instructor who had you, sounds like, going through some disaster scenarios. I mean, in terms of a preparation, preparing for potential problems.
Right. That's what I talked about a little bit earlier with procedures. They, you know, every time you get in the airplane, they ask you to, I actually had three different instructors, but they would all say, I want to see, what are you going to do if the engine quits? And you would go through all the procedures. And what you do is you make this so that it's an automatic a reaction to the situation, and because it removes the emotion. And then sometime during your flight training, they pull the engine back to nothing while you're flying when you're not looking, you know, and then they just say, you just lost your engine, now what are you going to do?
Wow.
But you find that what happens is, and I've read stories about guys that have had this actually happen. Fortunately, I didn't, but and they would say, you know, one guy described, he took off, he got to about 1,000 feet and the engine just quit. And he said his first reaction was, this can't be happening. The second one was this sort of onset of panic. And then the mantra of pilots is fly the plane first. And, it, you know, because you start thinking about other things and the airplane gets in a bad attitude and then you can't recover from it. So he said he immediately heard his instructor saying, fly the plane first, do what you got to do. And he just snapped back into these procedures and they were just automatic, and he ended up landing in a farm field and walked away.
Let me try Greg again. And this is Greg from South Jersey. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times, Greg.
Oh, hi, Marty and Tom. I do a communications and public relations function for the Sun Ra Orchestra.
Oh, wow.
And Sun Ra only paid the orchestra members to rehearse and not to perform. He always felt that being ready through rehearsals was the key, and that the performances would naturally flow in their improvisational way. And only those that rehearsed would perform with a band. And I was curious, Tom, is your reaction to that?
That's fascinating.
It is fascinating.
Ahead.
It kind of reminds me of something that I read many years ago in the 1970s. There was an Olympic coach for the American archery team, and he was struggling against the Asian teams because the Asian teams were very present moment oriented and not goal oriented. So their focus was totally on the process of drawing the bow. And because of that, the bullseye just got in the way of the arrow. The Americans were very attached to getting bullseyes, and so it didn't work very well. And it to me, there's a parallel to your story in that their focus is on rehearsal and practice, and then the performance happens naturally as an outcome of that.
Greg, thanks for the call to Radio Times. But that's so fascinating to think about getting paid to practice but not actually getting paid for the performance.
Well, and you're getting paid for preparation. That's a wonderful story.
It sure is. And we're going to take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Thomas Sterner. We are talking about practice, the value of practice. We have just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. He was the chief concert piano technician for the Grand in Wilmington, Delaware. He's an accomplished musician, private pilot, as he told us, an avid golfer, and author of a book called The Practicing Mind, Developing Focus and Discipline in Your Life. And David Kim, waiting in the wings. He is the concertmaster for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Philadelphia Orchestra. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Lincoln, introducing the new 2013 Lincoln MKS with available 16-speaker THX surround sound and independent suspension. More at Lincoln.com. Lincoln, now it gets interesting.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. Continuing education at PAFA offers art classes and workshops for all ages and levels this summer, including landscape, watercolor, portrait painting, and more. Featuring pre-college drawing and painting for high school students, the Summer Academy for Teachers, master classes with renowned artists, and classes on location at historic Yellow Springs, Chester Springs Studio. For details, pafa.edu/ce.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Australia is pulling its troops out of Afghanistan earlier than planned. Should Americans do the same? Military analyst Bing West says no. Also, Ron Rash's dark fairy tale of World War I Appalachia. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
William Penn Charter School supports WHYY. A friend school for boys and girls, Penn Charter opens its doors to the community for a pre-K to 8th grade open house Tuesday, May 1st at 8:30 a.m. Details and educational philosophy are at penncharter.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. One of the pleasures of attending a concert at the Philadelphia Orchestra or performed by the Philadelphia Orchestra is watching Concertmaster David Kim perform. He's been playing the violin since he was 3 years old and has performed all over the world. In fact, he is joining us from Tennessee. We were interested in what he would say about practice and we asked him to join us. And David Kim, it's been a couple of years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Good to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you as well. I know you'll be playing with the Knoxville Symphony Orchestra this Thursday and Friday. Are you practicing?
I am, and it's one of the necessary evils of my job because I don't particularly enjoy practicing, I have to be honest.
And why, you sent us an email to that effect, and I have to say I was pretty shocked when I read that. Why don't you like to practice?
Well, I think part of it is I don't want to miss out on the rest of life. I mean, I don't mean to make it sound philosophical, but my family will tell you my best practice is done in the kitchen while everybody's cooking and doing homework around me. I don't want to go into a room by myself. I want to be kind of still part of the action. And I think there's a bit of history there. Having practiced so much as a child and forced to do it, that perhaps it conjures up some poor memories. So I'm one of those musicians who hates to practice.
Well, that's so interesting. And you did write about the fact that when you were little, I guess about 3 years old, your mom put, as you say, this 1/8 size violin into your hands. And it seemed like she was a pretty tough task mistress in terms of making you practice.
Oh, absolutely. My mother is the reason I am where I am now as a musician making a living playing the violin. And she had that quintessential Asian work ethic, mm-hmm. as many of my parents' generation do. And they've passed it down, but God only knows how much of it has reached this next generation. And then my children's generation, how much of that Asian work ethic will stick to them. It's a great mystery, but I'd like to think that we're keeping it going a bit.
Yeah, well, and just to underscore that, when you were 8 years old, she was having you practice 5 hours a day.
Yes, it was torture, Marty.
Unbelievable.
It was absolute torture, and I acted out and rebelled and in many, many different ways, but one of the ways I never rebelled or spoke out was to say, I quit. It just somehow never entered my mind that I would quit. It was so ingrained into my daily life. I never spent a day of my life, as far as I could remember, not playing the violin. So therefore, I could say I hated it. I could say that I didn't want to practice that particular hour. But it was never the moment where I said, you know what, I quit. And as I say to many people who I meet in my travels, I wish I had a nickel for every one of those people I've met in my life who said, oh, I used to play the piano,
yeah.
or I used to play an instrument, yeah. but I quit.
Yeah, but you didn't do that. But it's interesting that you practice now surrounded by what sounds like your family. I mean, in the sort of hubbub of the kitchen as opposed to off in some quiet little corner somewhere.
Yes, and sometimes my family will hear me yelling at myself, come on, DK, come on, get your head in the game. You know, I'm just trying anything to try to get myself to practice. I mean, I will clean the entire house before I want to, before I practice. I'll find any kind of distraction. And, you know, I find this with a lot of my contemporaries and peers, colleagues. I was just with Carter Bray, the principal cellist of the New York Philharmonic. He said the same thing, same thing.
So do you enjoy playing? You had referenced, actually, Andre Agassi's biography, which I loved as well. I thought it was fascinating. He hated to practice, but it sounds like he also hated tennis. Do you enjoy playing when you're surrounded by an orchestra?
Oh, of course. That's the great reward at the end, and that's why ultimately I do practice and that I do find ways eventually to get myself to work, whether it might be, okay, if I can learn this this work by 3 o'clock, then I'll reward myself with a glass of wine at 4:30 or something, some kind of reward, or we'll go to Starbucks and get a mocha latte or something. It's just finding any way to do it, because I know the reward at the end is so satisfying and so meaningful.
I mean, would it be fair to say you're a perfectionist? I mean, you are, you know, I've seen you perform. You're extraordinary. Do you think of yourself as a perfectionist?
Oh, thanks. I am not one of those people. And, you know, there are nights where my stand partner and I will look at each other after maybe perhaps not the best night, where we've one or the other of us has made a mistake, and we'll look at each other like, well, good thing nobody died. It's not like we're heart surgeons or neurosurgeons. Mm-hmm. We make a mistake, and 99.9% of the time, nobody knows except us.
Right, but knowing that, is that bothersome to you?
It can be. It can be embarrassing and all this, but if you let it get to you too much, it's going to drive you crazy, because we play hundreds of concerts a year under great stress and pressure with the world's greatest conductors and soloists, and we're all human, and all of us make mistakes all the time, really. I mean, we're human beings, and we are created flawed, and so, you know, we just have to try our best, try to be prepared, but in the end, we're all human.
Yeah. What do you tell your students about practice? And then I'll get Tom Sterner back in on the conversation.
Sure. Well, I don't really have any private pupils or students or a studio of my own, but I do a lot of coaching, like I just did just now, a master class, and you know, I try to encourage them to the old Vince Lombardi adage that it's not practice that makes perfect, it's perfect practice that makes perfect. And so I am not of the type who encourages his kids to practice 5 hours a day or 6 hours a day. And I think that if it's efficiently done and thoughtfully done, that practice can be done more efficiently and in a shorter amount of time. And it can be more kind of stimulating and refreshing to practice in that way rather than doing the sheer number of hours.
Well, Tom, let me get you back in on the conversation. And talking with David Kim, or DK, as he calls himself, it's interesting to think about. I mean, here's a world-class violinist, a musician, talking about his struggles with practice. Does that surprise you at all?
No, not at all, because if you ask most golfers, you know, even the best in the world, as soon as they walk off the course, the last thing they want to do is practice golf. I mean, they want to go on a fishing trip. I'm curious, David, when you were young, was playing the violin your decision, or did like your mom say, you know what, you're going to play the violin?
Well, Tom, my mother decided that I would be a concert violinist when I was in utero, literally. She was still in graduate school, and she became pregnant with me, and she made the decision. She was a concert pianist, and she loved the violin as much as she loved the human voice, which was really her favorite. But you know, with a human voice, if you're not born with that great instrument in your throat, then there's not much you can do. But she was determined that she would have one child, a son, and that she would train that son to become a concert violinist. And she set about doing that even when I was in utero. I thought she was quite, now looking back, quite revolutionary. She would always have classical music going in the background, and if something unseemly came on TV, she would leave the room and things like that. And then it was complete and total immersion into classical music. I was listening to Alban Berg operas when I was 4 and 5 years old, and Palestrina, and it was just a pretty intense childhood.
It almost sounds like something you'd see a documentary on the Discovery Channel. You know, it's just very, very unusual. Mm-hmm. And the 5 hours to me is a lot. I know that one of the problems with children when they're learning is that they, particularly something like a musical instrument, is that they really don't have a perception of what it would be like to play well. So to them, the practice thing is, why am I doing this? You know, whereas it's really that works against adults, because when I used to have, in my piano service business, I had a lot of adults that had the car and the house and all this, and they wanted to be part of something bigger than themselves. So they'd buy a nice piano and say, I'm going to take music lessons. And they were so they were anticipating being able to play so well that it was really in their way when they practiced, because they felt like this is just so difficult. And it's just kind of an irony that for the children that works almost for them, but it can work against them too.
And David, Tom and I were talking about the kind of voices that we all carry around in our heads, sometimes the voices that tell us that we're not good enough. And it sounds like your mother was such a powerful influence in your life, and, you know, someone that had decided, as you said, in utero, that you were going to be a concert violinist. Is her voice in your head?
It is. It is. But more in amusement now. she unfortunately passed away when I was 14.
Yeah.
Yes, there are many moments where I'll be playing a piece that I've played since I was 7 or 8 years old, and I will remember her literally bonking me on the top of the head with a book of etudes or yelling. I mean, I cried every day.
Oh,
every
geez.
Day there were tears of bitterness and pain. I didn't want to be inside practicing all those hours. I have to say, though, Tom and Marty, that not all those hours were spent just practicing. Some of those hours were spent recording. My mother wanted to have an archive. She was so sure that I would be famous. Some of the hours were spent listening. Some hours were spent ear training next to the piano, trying to develop absolute pitch. She had the boot camp mentality.
Yeah.
Well, also,
and here you are. But no, go ahead, Tom.
I was going to say also, David, your earlier discussion of basically what I'll call practice with a purpose is really proved out through the studies that they've done. It's much more effective, and your brain learns much quicker when you have an intention and you're practicing with a purpose and in a mindfulness, and you know what you're after, as opposed to just going through the motions of it. So you're absolutely right with that.
Well, and interestingly, Tom, you said, you know, to be practicing 5 hours a day probably is counterproductive. Is it important to be able to walk away from what you do? Sometimes you can get some clarity. You know, you're focused so much on a project, and if you feel like you're not making progress, go take a walk outside, and somehow the ideas, you know, come flooding in.
Well, I think in terms of creativity, that's absolutely true. But it doesn't sound like in David's situation, he really had a choice about that. I mean,
right.
There was a certain regiment that he had to go through on a daily basis. Now, on the other end of that, we have this brilliant violinist.
Exactly.
So, I mean, we can say it wasn't all for naught, although the experience of it on his end, you know, was certainly not that pleasant.
David, I'm curious about before a concert, and I know you're going to be soloing with the orchestra down in Tennessee, and also with the Philadelphia Orchestra as well. Are there certain rituals, certain things you do to prepare yourself before a performance?
Yes, and they keep changing those rituals, Marty, because as we know, with age, our bodies change and, well, unfortunately, deteriorate a bit. Mm-hmm. And so I'm constantly modifying my rituals. And but I must say, in terms surely of practice, I would say as the concert draws closer, my practice in two ways becomes more intentional. One is slow, kind of just boring, slow practice to just make sure everything lines up. And then also run-throughs. I might just sit my 11-year-old daughter down to play through and try to simulate that kind of getting nervous and having to play through without stopping. Mm. And so those are the kind of things. And then, of course, there are all these other dumb little rituals like, you know, particular foods or bananas or water or whatever.
And, but those rituals, I think, can kind of give you the feeling that things are going to be okay, right?
Absolutely. I was just teaching that to a young musician just now, and sometimes it can be as simple as bowing slowly and not wiping the sweat off my hands on my tuxedo pants right before I play, but it could be something as ritualistic as raising my eyebrows in the second bar of a piece. It's just a comfort level and something that when you're nervous, anything that you can hold on to that you've practiced over and over again, whether it is musical or something as mundane as maybe tapping my tongue against the roof of my mouth. It sounds crazy,
yeah,
but it can be something that I will do every time at a particular bar, and it just gives me just a little comfort, like, okay, I've gotten past that point. I've practiced that a million times. So in essence, you're the You're the crying baby, and you're the mommy.
Go ahead, Tom.
I find that so fascinating, David, because, you know, in sports, particularly, again, I hate to always go back to golf, but it's just an area where this is utilized so much, is they have the pre-shot routine. And the whole purpose of a pre-shot routine is to give the golfer something to grab a hold of when their nerves are really high. And it's usually like a swing thought, and there's a routine. And they practice this routine, you know, down to how many seconds it takes them to do the routine. They stand behind the ball and they make their visualization, and then they walk to the side of the ball, and everything they do is practiced as part of the routine. And then they will give themselves a swing thought to hopefully occupy the left side of the brain if they're right-handed, so it doesn't dominate and let their intuitive side take over with the golf swing.
Well, we're almost out of time here, but it reminds you a little bit of a lucky charm. And you hear about pitchers that, you know, they hold the ball a certain way, or they might have something in their pocket that gives them the kind of confidence, the ritual.
Yeah, it's a comfort. It's something to grab a hold of, you know, in a stressful time or when you're nervous, that brings you back into a feeling of being comfortable and ready.
Well, on that note, first of all, to you, David Kim, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times. Nice to have you back on the show, even if by telephone.
Thank you, Marty. It was a pleasure.
A pleasure to have you on. Concertmaster of the Philadelphia Orchestra, a job he's had since 1999. And Thomas Turner, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Marty. It was a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. The book is called The Practicing Mind, Developing Focus and Discipline in Your Life. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're going to close things out with David Kim playing banjo and fiddle by composer William Kroll, accompanied by Gail Neva. Let's listen to this. You'll be